We're just, why don't we dive in? We've got two new faces here on the last panel. Don't mean to startle you with two new faces all of a sudden here at the end, but Andrea and myself are joining Rob and Paul, who will be back in a second, to talk about sustainability. Andrea has been involved in the Retirement for Ages initiative and involved in other volunteer activities for the Academy and throughout the profession. I've personally been involved in the Retirement 2020 initiative and Retirement for Ages all the way from the beginning. So it's fantastic to be here and see this kind of culmination, at least for the time being, in this session that we're having today. So sustainability, of course, is really what it's all about. Retirement for the ages, of course, implies if we have a system, a retirement system for the ages, that's going to be a sustainable system. And the Retirement 2020 was inspired by the idea that defined benefit plans were not sustainable in the way that they were being operated 10 or 15 years ago. So really the whole objective of Retirement for the Ages, Retirement 2020, is sustainability. How do we make these systems last? Alignment, governance, efficiency, all of these things can contribute to sustainability. So sustainability is as much the goal or objective as it is a characteristic or something that we're trying to build in just by itself. To me, I guess sustainability is about meeting expectations and keeping promises. If we're meeting expectations that people in the system have, that employers, plan sponsors have for costs, the system is sustainable. If we're keeping promises to participants in the system, then we have something that's sustainable. So that's really our ultimate goal here. Intergenerational equity, a significant part of this. How do we make sure that the stakeholders are paying for the benefits that are being earned today and that we're not passing those on to future generations, or that costs from prior generations are not being passed on or are not being borne today? Those are the kind of things, obviously, that are going to make a system unsustainable. People aren't going to be willing to bear the costs of other generations, and that's going to lead to unsustainable systems. Proper cost allocation. So here we're thinking about employees, employers, shareholders, taxpayers. We need to make sure that costs are allocated between all these different stakeholders, or again, these stakeholders are not going to be willing to bear the costs, and the system is going to prove unsustainable. Market shock. So here's a big one, and of course one that we've experienced significantly in the last decade or so, market shocks. And we need to design systems that anticipate market shocks and how we're going to survive them. 2008 and the whole last decade of market shocks shouldn't be thought of as an anomaly. Certainly unusual, but we have to think about these things as things, situations that are going to occur. They're not going to occur often necessarily, but they are going to occur, and we have to set up our systems to anticipate that and survive these kinds of market shocks. And then finally, a real key aspect that we talked about from the beginning today is balancing sustainability and adequacy. It's easy to design a sustainable system, but that system may not be adequate. So this balance between sustainability and adequacy is a significant thing. I mean, there's little meaning to a system, defined contribution system, where half the people participate, no one knows how to deal with the investments, no one saves enough, and all the risk is shifted to the participants. At the same time, there's little hope for a defined benefit system where an employer takes all the risk and provides generous benefits, there's little hope for that system to be sustainable. So we need to balance these two things. So those are our principles behind sustainability. The intergenerational equity, cost allocation, withstanding market shocks, and maintaining a balance between sustainability and adequacy. With that, we can turn to some questions, see if we can challenge people, challenge all of you to come up with some good answers to these puzzlers. So in a funded system, is it acceptable for funded levels to vary between, say, 80% and 110%? Or is that a sustainable approach to have such variability in the funded status of a system? Are people, members, other stakeholders going to be too concerned about the system when it's poorly funded? And are we going to overpromise things when a system is overfunded? Thoughts on that? Paul?
Yeah, sustainability is a function of the demographics of the group. So let me take three separate plans: the teacher's plan, the public service plan, and the hospital professionals plan. Teaching's a declining industry in New Brunswick. Birth rates are going down, school sizes are going down, and the teacher's pension plan, 65% of the liabilities relate to retired life liabilities, and the plan has to disinvest every year in order to pay the teachers. Public service, roughly stable. On the hospital system, on the other hand, we're into a growth industry. The growth industry is looking after the elderly. And they have very, very positive cash flow. Contributions exceed benefits out. Proportion of the liabilities, their retired life liabilities, are fairly low. They're into a hiring mode. I think it's obvious that if you have a plan with strong cash flow, it can take greater risks on the asset side than if you have a plan that's disinvesting. And that indeed is what our risk analysis indicates. So you have to have a much higher proportion of bonds and infrastructure in the teacher's plan. And you can have a higher proportion of equities and private equities in the hospital plan.
Right.
So the first thing to do in risk analysis, obviously, is to look into the future and see what your cash flows look like. If your cash flows are strong and positive, you've got a lot more leeway. And if your cash flows are negative, you have a lot less leeway, at least if you're looking after the interests of the plan participants and the plan sponsor.
Yeah, and let's come back to that, because to me, it's really an important one. As you say, maybe kind of the essence of sustainability is understanding the demographics. Andrea or Rob, thoughts on the funded status and uncertainty or volatility in the funded status?
You know, Paul and I are very similar in some of our ideas of the fiscal issues here. For us, at least in our plan, we find the working in the range of 80 to 120, as opposed to the 110, is our thresholds for where we want to be. Obviously, our goal is to be above 100 virtually all the time. We recognize that before any consideration of improvement, you need to have every consideration of sustainability in the form of greater than 120%, in our opinion, before any consideration of that. And our threshold for taking action here in the States, many times we're hearing plans down in the 60s and 70% funded levels. We think 80 is really the minimum, and have structured to be with that. So we work within that kind of range for our work, and for the long term here, it's been pretty good for us.
Andrea, thoughts?
Yeah, thoughts are, you know, is 110% enough? Is 120% enough? If we're looking at the funding methods most frequently used, projected unit credit methods, you know you have an increasing cost pattern over time as the demographics and the group ages. So I've always wondered if, you know, we should be looking at the cost of these programs on more than just a projected unit credit method, mm-hmm. to see if really we're trying to come up with level cost over, we talked about intergenerational issues, and if the cost continues to rise through these programs, then isn't that costing more to future generations? And shouldn't we be looking at trying to level that out more? Mm-hmm. So I'm always concerned about those flat out limits when you're saying we have 110% or 120%, we can now give benefit improvements. When you need to, I think, look at the demographics and the long-term cost of these programs.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, we agree with that completely. And one of the big moves we made was to get away from the projected unit credit method completely. So the open group funded ratio, where you're looking, always looking 20 years into the future, really is much more comparable to an aggregate method in terms of funding than a projected unit credit method. And, you know, if you go back to good old TSA 1, 1948 or 49, when they were recommending projected unit credit, it was based on the idea of increased employment and stable population or expanding population. Well, we don't have those factors now, except with the hospital care system. Mm-hmm. So one of the moves we made was to say we're not going to use the projected unit credit system for funding pensions anymore. We're always going to be looking 20 years out in the future to see what it looks like. And it's not an aggregate system, but it incorporates a lot of the concepts of an aggregate system in terms of stability.
Well, I'd like to get any thoughts from the audience on this question about funded status and just the idea that we overpromise when we're overfunded and we maybe find it hard to recover when we're underfunded.
Evan, in our work, we've typically said it doesn't really matter what your funded ratio is, it matters what direction it's going. And so if it's on a nice steady path upward based on what you think is going to happen on a stochastic basis or deterministic basis, that's really what you want to see. And so I'm glad to see that Paul's focus is on the 20-year open group analysis. That to me, that's the most important. Negative cash flow now, is that going to change because we've got commitments by the plan sponsor to infuse future contributions at a higher level? All that gets taken into account in an open group projection.
Other thoughts on the issue of funded status? Well, let's come back to the concept that Paul's raised here, because it is so important that demographics change, and we don't always know, or we often usually don't know how the demographic situation is going to change over the long term, certainly. I mean, General Motors in the 1980s didn't realize that they would have been 30 or 40% the size that they were at that time 10 or 20 years later. We've seen it throughout the manufacturing world that workforces have been downsized, and a huge issue that's caused defined benefit plans in that world to be unsustainable. I haven't always thought, but in recent years I've come to think that we really should be, in any of our defined benefit systems, be fully funding and immunizing, not just fully funded, but immunizing the retiree liabilities of our pension plans. And we should have very little, if any, equity investment related to those. So that is always taken care of. And if our investment strategy, if our asset allocation evolves along with the demographics of our plan, they will prove to be more sustainable. So the thoughts on that, or additional thoughts on the demographics and how to deal with that?
Well, in the regulations we created, we have a one-way switch. The moment the actuary becomes aware that the population will decrease, that there's a plan to reduce the workforce, it has to be reflected immediately in a 20-year projection. but the actuary is not allowed to build in a plan to expand the workforce until such time as it's a fact. And that gets out of regulatory experience, that people knew they were downsizing, but they didn't reflect it. And they changed the maturity of the plan, and all of a sudden you have inappropriate assets or inappropriate funded ratios. So we've put that direction right in the regs, the moment you know about any plan to downsize, that gets reflected immediately. And that's because if you're using something close to an aggregate method, you have to, you can't take credit for contributions that you know won't be made.
Yeah.
As for the moving entirely or wholly or whatever to fixed, even with the plan, the teacher's plan being two-thirds retired life liabilities, we don't get anything more than 45 or 50% fixed as the optimal rate. That provides enough stability. Maybe a little over 50, but with an extremely mature plan. But there's economic efficiency to be considered as well as stability, sustainability. And if you go much more towards fixed right now, what you're doing in our system, of course, is cutting back on future cost of living protection. And we figure cost of living protection in a system with increasing longevity is if not as important as the initial pension, it's very important. So maybe in this economy with 1% cost of living change, you're not too worried about it, but I certainly spent a good time of my working career up in double-digit inflation territory.
Yeah.
And saw my parents' retirement income decrease in value. And so one of the things we did when we went to the shared risk program is we took off all cost of living caps. So the old plan used to cover 100% cost of living or 75% cost of living up to 4% or 6%. Now, we decided if we're going to get in the business of protecting, we need to protect as long as we can pay for it. So all of the new plans, except one, the teachers, too mature, has removed the cost of living cap and for future cost of living adjustments.
Yeah, so very hard to immunize or very expensive to immunize right. A full cost of living
right.
Provision, yeah.
Our practice is each time we do an experience study, we do a companion asset liability modeling where we do demographic projections of increases and decreases in the population of the plan. Gives us a certain amount of strength in our ability to recognize issues, whether falling demographics or whatever the circumstance. It's just a part of our ongoing process. We have remained extremely stable for a number of years in a row, and so it hasn't played a big role in our efforts, but it is something that we always track through that process. We're probably, like Paul, you had one of the plans at 70% retired lives. We're pretty close to 50-50 with our plan, and with some of the features that we've included as far as variable costs relating to the COLA and a couple of the other features, we've probably maintained a more aggressive portfolio than what you would do normally on one that is a little more mature. Mm-hmm. So we try and build risk mitigation process into both the investment side and onto the plan administration side and try and build the balance between there and use those experience studies and asset liability modeling to give us the strength
sure.
of arguments.
And you need to consider that equities and bonds aren't the only assets that have the right characteristics. So alternative asset classes like infrastructure, worldwide infrastructure, are very nice, and the plans we're involved in have gone out and bought part of water distribution systems and things like that. People are going to need them. They have nice long-term characteristics. They tend to be related to the cost of living. And so you need to look at the alternative investment universe out there, too, when you're doing the planning for these things.
Particularly right now with our bond market where it's at, I think we're all, you mentioned that also, and we're minimal on our bond side right now just because what we think that it has a, the alternatives are looking much better, and it doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere fast.
Mm-hmm. Andrea,
and I was just going to mention, like over the last 5 years when the economy was really struggling, we did a lot of pension forecast for our employers when they were doing workforce planning.
Yeah.
And what we were seeing is within like a five-year period, something like 40 to 60% of their workforce would be eligible for retirement moving out because of the aging baby boomers moving into retirement eligibility. And then after 10 years, it was something like 80 or 70 or 80%. So they had a real crisis in replacing that workforce. But then what we realized is they were replacing workforce, but not in the U.S. They were talking about growing a lot of their business overseas and not here. So that further aggravated the pension plan kind of sustainability and what their strategy was, how to deal with those declining kind of populations in those defined benefit plans. So they had a lot of exit strategies that they were in the process of developing, which we all know about, you know, what they're doing.
Exit
with that.
Strategies for the pension.
For the pension,
exiting
DB,
out of the
exiting
pension
out of the DB plan. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. When primarily when interest rates rose, right? That was kind of you were talking about immunizing. Well, it's not a good time to immunize when interest rates are 3%, right? But if they go to 6%, someone might consider doing that, right?
Just picking up another issue on sustainability in the public service plans, almost all of the early retirement penalties were early retirement subsidies. They weren't close to the actuarial equivalent. So one of the things we decided, in terms of sustainability, why are we encouraging people to leave early? And we couldn't come up with an answer. So we moved the future service early retirement discounts much closer to the actuarial equivalents. And we didn't have any blowback from the unions involved. They understood why we were doing it.
That's a big issue for us right now. And we've actually gotten a little help in the sustainability realm here lately because during the last 5 years, we've upped our average age of retirement by a full year. People haven't gone out when we expected them to. Slowing down that early retirement has helped us a little bit here.
Yeah. Rob, remind us of what the early retirement provisions are in
we
your
have,
plan.
We have a rule of 85 at 55.
So it's unreduced at
85? At 55, potentially unreduced. We're running into an issue, as you say, workforce issues for us also. It's one of those benefit structures you loaded in 20 years ago when you thought you needed it. You need to clear the baby boomers to make room for what's followed. Well, if we were really quick on the draw, we would have realized we should have been kind of working our way out of that as the baby boomers were aging, because now we're going to find hard times replacing all of those people that ultimately will go.
Right.
In some ways, the timing to have them stay longer has helped us a little bit, though I don't like the option for our young people who are trying to look for work and people aren't turning over.
Right. So just following up on that, we eliminated all the magic age unreduced formulas except one for the teachers. And the reason we kept it for the teachers is that our history indicated that we had just a predominance of people who came in at age 24 and 25 and stayed in the profession in the province. So it wasn't a question of intermember equity. Nevertheless, we increased, we kept a magic age formula, we increased it by 4 years. And the particular early retirement provisions for police and fire were based on the idea that there were hazardous professions that shortened lifetime. But we got credible mortality statistics that indicated that police and fire live longer in retirement than regular clerical workers.
Oh, yeah.
So there wasn't, and actually California has quite a good study on the, which is California is almost the size of Canada, quite a good study on police and fire longevity. and the case just isn't there to be made. So it went.
Yeah.
And when we told the police and fire it had to go, we didn't get any resistance. They understand what the facts are.
Now, Paul, did you, I assume you needed to phase that out somehow? You couldn't just...
No, we kept it for all accrued service and phased it out for all future
Okay.
service. So they take a blended benefit when they retire.
Yeah.
Of the future service with the early retirement discount if they want to retire before the new unreduced early retirement age.
Yeah. Thoughts or questions on demographics and that issue related to sustainability? Okay, let's talk about guarantee funds, and I guess this might be especially for Paul and Andrea, who I assume are familiar with guarantee funds in your respective countries. Rob, you
not so much,
about it so much. But guarantee funds, do they enhance sustainability or do they create kind of a moral hazard where sponsors take risk and can kind of rely on the guarantee fund and do that at the to the detriment of the system?
We came to the conclusion that the traditional pension benefit guarantee corp or pension benefit guarantee fund was unsound. And did lead to moral hazard. But we also came to the conclusion that if the pension funds adopted the risk management and worked to guarantee the benefits with a probability of 97.5%, that the government could offer a pension benefit guarantee fund against reductions. So the government's announced it but hasn't legislated it yet.
So,
but the trick is no guarantee of any pension fund that isn't operating on a risk management basis.
So how would that, so what would the criteria for that be, the risk
well,
management
the
basis?
Well, the objectives are that we have base benefits and enhanced benefits, target benefits enhanced. The base benefits have to be priced or, to have a 97.5% probability.
So it's the provisions you described
right,
earlier.
And,
yeah.
And the enhanced benefits at a 75% probability. And if you manage to those constraints and worst happens, then the government can afford to run a pension benefit guarantee fund. But if you don't have the constraints, it's sort of like, well, I don't know if there's any bridge players in the room, but it's, if you're playing highs and lows, you don't win tournaments. The steady wins the bridge tournament.
Uh-huh. Andrea, thoughts on
right,
that?
Right, well, you know, there's a lot of people in the room who could talk more about the PBGC than I could ever talk about, for sure.
Right.
But just in general, we talked about the sustainability of these programs and the length of a retirement program is a long commitment, long-time commitment. And people outlive their employers for the most part,
mm-hmm.
Whether they've failed or they've been merged or whatever. So I think philosophically, the PBGC has played an extremely important role in our economy in underwriting and ensuring these promises that these employers have made to people to the degree that it does do the guarantee. On the other hand, there are employers out there who have taken advantage of that and said, well, if we have that underlying guarantee, then we can take more risk in the plan and then maybe enhance our adequacy
mm-hmm.
by being able to give bigger benefits. So again, I think you're looking at the particular employer and their advisors as to how they advise, and people will take advantage of, tax arbitrage or whether it's PBGC, whatever. But when you're working with boards that are fiduciaries of plans, and you talk about fiduciary training or fiduciary responsibilities, their responsibility is to ensure that those benefits are secure for their participants. And I think as an advisor, you always, move to the moral high ground, and you're saying that's your purpose here, not to take advantage of a program that's there to ensure the plans that fail. So that's just my own personal kind of advice that I've given over the years.
Yeah.
And a lot depends on your bankruptcy code, because if I take the failure of Nortel, which was one of Canada's largest manufacturers, the members of the UK pension plan had a claim on the preferred claim on the corporate assets of the company. The members of the Canadian plan were treated as unsecured creditors. So they stood at the end of the line. So when you're thinking about pension benefit guarantee, you also need to think about what happens in the in any bankruptcy insolvency restructuring provision. So
And I'd like to ask the group, has anyone been involved with employers who did take advantage of that moral hazard opportunity? Do you know a few? That's from the PBGC, right? You know a few, right?
Dave seems to have run into that before. That's interesting. Other thoughts there? Okay, well, let's think about one last question. Both of your systems have built in kind of some self-adjusting mechanisms, which in the Retirement 2020 and Retirement for the Ages process was a big thing, a kind of a focus, something that helped the governance, something that enhanced sustainability. But it's I would just wonder if you might share kind of some considerations about that. I mean, the first thing that seems to go is the cost of living increase. That seems to be expendable to some extent. But maybe just expand a little bit on the considerations around on what was flexible or what was deemed flexible.
Every plan that's registered as a shared risk plan has to prioritize the benefits and where they are in the order. So typically, cost of living benefits go first, and then the early retirement incentives, taking them and going back to early actuarial equivalents, tends to be number two, and so on. So there's usually a list of five or six items, prioritizing them as to what gets hit first and when. Mm-hmm. And the last thing to be hit is the amount of money paid out.
The actual accrued benefit?
Yep, yeah, absolutely. It's way down the list.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, each plan or system identifies those priorities on their
own. When they register, they have to list their funding policy as to what the priority of the benefits are if the plan gets underfunded. And depending, once you slip under 100% funded ratio, based on the plans you have, you're directed to reduce some of the ancillary benefits to get back to 100% funded. Mm-hmm. So. You were asking what's effective, what's acceptable before, and our view is 100% funded is the minimum we should accept. Mm-hmm. Now, we make provision that it has to be under 100% funded 2 years in a row, so we don't want to be whiplashed into turning benefits. But our view in designing the new system is anything under 100% funded is unsatisfactory. Mm-hmm.
We've approached the issue of flexible benefits a little bit the same way as you have. It's an important part of the overall structure. We have also identified where we want to make adjustments. If we need to make adjustments in the future, we haven't gone so far as to prioritize them. It's more identify them, and if and when that situation comes back, we will finalize that. It's more a group of just items that we would consider as opposed to specific today, and we'll see what
you have to go to the legislature, if I remember right.
We will have to go to the legislature. Uh-huh. Again, they're not only the legislature but all of our stakeholders are well aware of the dynamics that we have in law about what thresholds are need to be met, or if they are met, that we have to come back to them, and not only are they aware of it, they'd be expecting it. And so it just would be part of the process, and hopefully with good engagement and communication, when we get into those situations, we start communicating with them a lot. I would think we'd know the answer before it actually got drawn up as a bill.
And under our system, there's no such thing as contribution holidays. If you get over 140% funded, you have to start increasing the ancillary benefits. And that list is provided in advance, too.
Your contributions are fixed as well, if I remember.
Very similar, fixed, and in our case, it's the 120. But our 120 holds in that if you were to make an adjustment, it has to still maintain the 120,
right,
even after the adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Andrea, thoughts on self-adjusting mechanism?
Yeah, the only question I've really had, I guess, for Rob and Paul is that I think, Rob, you earlier mentioned that when you did your adjustment, the one downward adjustment, you tried to spread it across all of the members, right? And I know there are, and you mentioned just a minute ago, Paul, that the last thing you would do is reduce retiree benefits.
Right.
And I know there were some proposals, or there's some proposals out there that says when we make an adjustment downward in particular, everyone across the board, retirees, actives, everyone, takes a reduction.
Correct.
What do you guys think about that type of a proposal?
Yeah, it's a requirement.
And that's been our process, both going up and going down, is everybody shares in the good times and, yep, the not such good, yep, times.
So you don't protect the retirees' benefits necessarily at a priority above
retirees, deferred, vested, and actives are all members. They share in the same benefits. Yeah.
But we will try and do it in future. That's where the COLA adjustment works so well. Instead of lowering a benefit today, it's just not grow the benefit as quickly in the future.
Right, right.
We've added another program on the top end that we have not implemented yet, but what it amounts to is instead of a fixed type benefit, we would add a almost like a DC on top of the DB, an account-based benefit feature that would then at the time of retirement be able to be converted to either a benefit or else be available in wealth design. That's in line to be our next improvement if that happens. The ideal part of that, of course, is that as an account basis, it would grow with the marketplace or it would fall with the marketplace. So a certain amount of that liability, instead of going into a fixed liability, would go into a variable liability inside the pool.
Yeah. Yeah, so a real key, I think, to thinking about sustainability is these adjustment mechanisms. Well, let's thank all the panelists here.